Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Carl Carlson.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. And welcome. If this is your first time joining us, we welcome you to the conversation. Grab your cup of coffee and feel free to take notes or yell at us or whatever. You have the opportunity to actually do that as our longtime listeners, and welcome back. Also have known is that you can go over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there's ways, comment fields and forms and so on, and ways to get in touch with us. And we genuinely look forward to hearing from you as you join the conversation. So make that offer to you right at the start. And so, Carl, you know, last time we were talking about you introduced the idea of these three principles of reliability engineering. And the first one's really about the focus is on achieving reliability, not just calculating reliability. And so if you haven't heard that episode, it might be worth heading back or catching up with us on that episode, because I think these three principles really fit together nicely. And so today it's more around that we, is the way I phrase it, Carl, I think is a better bumper sticker, is it's always the designer's fault.
Okay, fair enough.
Right.
I don't know if you'll win that battle, but okay, we'll go over that for a while.
All right. Well, how do you phrase it, the second principle?
Okay, so the second principle is reliability must be designed into products and processes. And really this came about during the early 1990s as product development processes got shorter and shorter. I'll just lean on my vehicle experience, mm-hmm. vehicle engineering experience, and product development process was 48 months or longer from concept to
luxury
to actual production. Yeah, but you can call it a luxury, but it was really a burden because it doesn't work. The technology changes too fast in that 48 months, and the mm-hmm. competitors will steal your market share. And so GM knew, and the other automotive knew that we had to cut that down, had to work to get it to 36 months and 24 months and shorter. And there's basically huge paradigm changes in order to do that. It changed the types of methods you use. You no longer could do certain types of long vehicle testing. You had to accelerate testing, had to move to subsystems and components, and eventually move to virtual and analytical mm-hmm. Type methods. And so it changed your methodologies, and it changed a lot of things. And one thing it changed for us is we could no longer do a lengthy test and fix program where you design it any old way from a reliability standpoint. In other words, reliability was the afterthought. You designed the product. Yeah.
The literal throw it over the wall kind of.
Yeah.
You know, here, you guys make it reliable.
Somebody else designs it, and then reliability comes in and fixes it so it's reliable.
Right.
That model no longer worked.
Right, right.
And and of course, the corollary to it is you had to design in reliability. And so the topic for us to talk about is, what do we mean by that?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you had at HP, we called it a design for reliability manual, which included a number of these principles. And it was really a document for the design teams, for the developers. At HP, it was primarily for electrical engineers and mechanical engineers. And later we added more for software folks. But it was sets of guidelines and lessons learned and good practices and ways to go about thinking about reliability as a designer. And then a big part of it was allowing them to measure it, to quantify the importance of a small change in failure rate. You know, I'm going to save a 0.25% on a failure rate. It's the so what factor is, well, that means given our product and how much it costs when it fails and the impact to our customers, that means it's worth $2,000 per percentage. Now I can calculate it out times the number of units I have, but we made sure that the design teams could do that. And so it became a very visible trade-off when they were comparing cost of components or time to market or whatever factors were important in their design decisions. And a big part of what the approach that Dick Moss brought to HP was you got to enable the design teams, the development teams, to make the right decisions, because you're not going to be a part of those. You're not going to be there. You have to let them learn how to make those decisions and then make the right ones. And that was a huge focus for us.
Yeah, the that influence, if we could use that word, is really important. I was as you were talking, I was thinking, and I know you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to actually listen, but I was thinking, Fred, while you were talking. And I was thinking that this parses out the skill or the strategy of designing and reliability. I'm seeing two separate strategies. One I'll call methods, focusing on certain methods. So if you want to design in reliability, you don't so much focus on reliability growth as a method. Reliability growth has its place.
Right, which is the quintessential build, test, fix, right?
Yes.
That's what you mean by that.
Yep. And there are other methods that for designing in reliability are more effective. And for instance, selectively targeted FMEAs. In other words, FMEAs done under the right circumstances.
Well, let's actually plug your book there. You said effectively, and that's the title of your book, Effective yes. FMEAs. You know, come on.
I do bias towards the word effective, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Because FMEAs, you don't want to do FMEAs on everything.
Right.
You want to use it selectively under the right circumstances, so then they can become effective. Strategies to increase design margins, strategies like P diagrams, where you understand the knobs that achieve reliability, and you help people determine those strategies, like design of experiments, and lots more, robust design done properly. All these are examples of strategies that can change designs early in the process and help, like you mentioned, help designers make the right decisions.
That's right.
So that...
Well, there's
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'd expand on that a little bit in that, I mean, there's most of our products, not all of our products, but many of our products are built on existing technologies and previous generations of a product. And often, sometimes, many times, we have the luxury of our customers telling us what's wrong with a product. And our continued development work goes, here's opportunities to make it more robust or improve it, or we need to address these issues that we didn't have enough margin. And so oftentimes a design team starts a development process by looking at the history and what went well and what didn't work so well. And it can be a quality focus thing. It can be a feature set focus thing. It can be a competitive landscape kind of focus. What we bring is, well, what is the durability side of it? What works and doesn't work long term, and where's the opportunities there? We often also work with, well, what was the impact of these different failure mechanisms? Let's put some dollar signs on these things. And so let's not just say this failed a whole bunch of time. This one failed twice, but it was very expensive. Let's take a look at that. And so on. I think there's part of the process is looking at improving the design itself. And I think the way you phrased it, Carl, was looking at, well, what's at risk in our current design space? What has either uncertainty, how well it will work over time, or what do we perceive or know is going to be a risk? And then what can we do about it? And part of our role is to expose those things. The other part is to roll up our sleeves and say, well, here's alternatives. Here's how can we explore it. Here's how we can get more information. Here's the right questions to ask your supplier. I learned the hard way, Carl, that you never ask a supplier, so is your product reliable?
No. Wrong question.
Yeah. Right. So I think the idea of designing in reliability is not just expect somebody else to do it, is that you have to enable them to do it and help them do it.
Exactly. And which brings up the second of the two focus areas. One is methods, and the second is influence.
Right.
And we've talked a lot about this, because the soft skills of reliability are so important. As you get shorter product development times, it didn't used to be this way. You know, if you think decades ago, where there was a long product development process, then you could spend more time in silos, and you could throw over the wall and still fix in time for launch.
Right.
But with short product development times, it's essential that products are developed with concurrent engineering. In other words, all the different disciplines, such as reliability, come together early in the product development process and influence the design. In order to do that, reliability practitioners have to have people skills in addition to technical skills.
Yeah. It's very typified by, you don't walk into the room with a broken prototype and say, "I told you so." You have to build the credibility so that when you identify a salient risk, that you have the history and credibility built up with the team, that they go, "Oh yeah, you're right. We need to analyze that." So it takes time and skill to develop that credibility. And then you can really streamline and influence teams.
Yeah, and some people ask, well, do you have to be, in order to design in reliability, does the reliability person have to be expert in the design? And the answer is not yes. In other words, you do not have to be expert in the design. You have to be expert in the methods that achieve reliability in design. Mm-hmm. There's a nuance there that's very important, because I don't want people to think, well, to influence the design of a capacitor, if you're a reliability engineer and your company's building capacitors, do you have to be an expert in capacitors? No, you have to be an expert in the reliability methods, and then bring that expertise as a team member to influence the decisions that the designers are making.
That's right. And it's the same as any other discipline. Even a capacitor has mechanical elements to it, electrical elements to it, chemistry elements to it, manufacturing elements to it. And those are often represented by different people and or teams. And so we bring in, how do those things interact and influence and behave and over time? That's what we bring to it.
Yeah. There's another aspect to this, because you're correct that over time is an aspect. But think about this second principle is reliability must be designed into products and processes. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk for a minute about how do you achieve reliability processes. So that's not the same thing as reliability or the performance over time.
No.
That's the performance of the manufacturing process.
Well, Carl, that goes back. You've heard me say this before, and I opened this topic with that it's always the designer's fault. And I learned that as a manufacturing engineer, is you know, I can't make your design better than it is. If I create it to the design, that's as good as it gets. I can make it worse. I can add lots of variability to it. I can add impurities to it. I can add faults into it. I can add cracks to it. I can do all kinds of horrible things to your design, and it won't work as well. And so I learned that early on as a manufacturing engineer and working with designers, is that a big part of what I did in manufacturing was to make sure our assembly processes were as consistent as possible. So SPC, and we ran tons and tons of design of experiments to optimize our process to be as robust as possible. So at the end of the day, we got a consistent, clean, as close as possible to the design as possible result. And that was, looking back, is we were working in the space of reliability engineering. We were trying to get rid of all late excuses for latent defects in the product as it went out the door.
Yeah, and this is a really an emphasis point. Reliability engineering is not merely the product design. It's also the manufacturing process. And design for reliability is not merely the product design. It's also the manufacturing process.
Oh, and the supply chain too, yeah.
And the supply chain, exactly. So everyone comes together early in that product development process. So you have the manufacturing engineer present. You have the supplier connections are involved as soon as they've been chosen. So how do you influence the manufacturing? How do you design in reliability to manufacturing? Comes down to things like design error proofing, design for manufacturing, design for assembly. There's a lot of tools mm-hmm. that can help to do that. We want to have, there's process FMEAs. There's a lot of tools that fit on both the design side as well as the process side, and we want to get DFR applied to both.
That's right. Yeah, and it came up in a comment the other day. Is there a strong or a hard line between design for manufacturability, design for manufacturer, or in design for reliability? And I came at that question with no, not really. We're often after the same goals. We just have different areas of influence and focus. And the reliability folks will use tools like SPC regularly to minimize early life failures, for example, is one class of defects that a good manufacturing process will improve. Manufacturing engineers are also concerned about the durability and robustness of their equipment, because downtime affects them, right? Affects their ability to achieve throughput and production concept or targets. And so they're concerned with the traditional reliability of their equipment. And we overlap a lot.
There is a lot of overlap. I mean, DFM or DFA are specific methods, but they definitely overlap. And I actually think DFR is more of an umbrella of techniques
spoken as a true reliability engineer.
Yes. Well, it's raining here, so I sort of got the concept.
That's right. Well, I think that's the core of the second principle, is that it's designed in, and I think the other part we're talking about, it really alludes to our third principle, which we'll come back and talk about real quick, is that it's not just the design, it's not just the reliability engineer. And so in summary, the focus isn't necessarily, and we squirrel away and do calculations, and we don't talk to the design teams, and we hope that it works out. It's really not what we do. I think the three principles are, and the second one is core. If it's not possible to create a reliable product, to achieve reliability, unless the design team and the engineers developing the product and process are working in and with this reliability engineering concepts and tools. From the beginning. And it's not a throw it over the wall. It's not hope we can work it out. You got to do it right at the start.
Good summary.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Carl. And it sounds like the rain's tapered off a bit there. So hopefully it's not too muddy out there and you can get out and get your bike ride in and stuff like that.
Sounds good.
We'll talk to you later, Carl.
Talk to you later.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.